Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, editor of Books Ireland, and joining me today is author Jackie Lynham, whose debut collection Traces is out now. Jackie, I know that you started school really, really young, like just about turned 4 years old when you went to school, which is incredible. What was that like, being such a tiny little girl in school?
Yeah, do you know, I don't remember it being a problem. We lived in Stirlibatter in Kearney Street, and the school was at the end of the street, the St. Gabriel's National School, and it was a small enough school, and I think they just needed extra bodies. So my sister was already in there, so they probably just asked my mother, you know, are there more people coming along? So I turned four in December and started school then in January. So I missed those first few months. But you'd never do that now. Like, there's no way you'd put a child into junior infants and just slot them in without those first couple of months. But I don't remember it being a big deal, because my mom had taught me to read and write before I went to school. So I had those basics. So I don't feel like I went in with a disadvantage. Now, having said that, when we moved, so my childhood was kind of divided into two. So we lived for the first 8 years of my life in Stirlibatter, and then when I was just almost eight, we moved to Raheny, and then I was put back into second class. So they thought I was too young, so I then went back into second class and repeated it, but repeated it in a different school, so it didn't really feel like it was a big deal. But they did think, oh yeah, no, she's too young to go into third class. But I don't remember feeling like I was the smallest there. I think I was, because my mom had spent that time with me teaching me to read and write, I didn't feel like I was falling behind or anything like that.
So you just have to go back to your mom teaching you to read and write before even then. So, like, do you have any kind of, it's probably very dim memories of, like, you know, before you're three and everything, but do you have any memories of learning to read?
I do remember my mom having those, is it Barry and Anne? Was that the name of those books? Those little reader books. And there, I mean, I was very lucky that I grew up in a household where there was huge emphasis placed on reading. My mom and dad are both from working class backgrounds, and they both left school at 14. But my mom always says that she was a reader from a young age, and if anybody came into the house, where is Nora? She's stuck in a book somewhere. And for her, it was the library. So she lived in North Strand, and Charlotte Amal Library was her local library. And she was clever, and she was offered a scholarship to go on to secondary school, which she didn't take, because she was the second eldest of a family of 10. They were very poor. My granddad was a docker, and his wage was very unreliable because they got paid by the day. And you never knew whether you were going to get work, because you had to, you know, you would stand there and wait to be chosen. So, things were really tight. And my mom, as I said, is the second eldest. So they were kind of waiting for her to leave school to go work. And she says, I mean, she's brilliant. She never regretted that decision. She said she doesn't believe in looking back and, you know, what things could have been. She could have had a very different life if she had stayed on school. You know, she ended up working in factories. She was dying to leave school. So the nun had called her mom up to the school to say, look, Nora is very bright and we'd like her to go to secondary school. And my mom was horrified. She didn't know anybody that went to secondary school. It wasn't something that was ever spoken about. It wasn't, you know, everybody was talking about leaving school and going to work. And that's all she knew. And in fairness to her mother, she said to her, listen, if you really want to go to school, we'll find the money for your uniform and your books. We'll find it somehow. And she said, no, I'm going out to work. So she went off to work, but the library remained her huge source. That was her education then. So she, even though she left school and her formal education stopped, it was her informal education continued through the library. And she always says that the best present she ever got was the library card for the adult part of Charlotte Amal Library. So on her 14th birthday, which was the 7th of September, 1954, she ran down from her house in Bayview Avenue in North Strand, down to Charlotte Amal Library, in to get her library card. And to this day, she's 83, she will still say that was the best birthday present she ever got.
Wow.
So that's the kind of house that I grew up in, Ruth. It was just books were everything. She always says you were never lonely if you have a book. And so my dad was a reader too, and the two of them, they would read stories to myself and my sister at night. All Ina Blyton books were the books for that part of my childhood in Stirlibatter. It was all Ina Blyton books that I read. My mom would get them in the library. There was a mobile library that used to stop in Stirlibatter. And then I think a few times we went to the one in Capel Street, but mostly it was the mobile library. And then my mom would go into Mead Street and Palmer Street on a Saturday afternoon. There was markets on there. So she'd bring back secondhand copies, and myself and my sister would fight over them. And then we'd reenact all the scenes in the books in our bedroom. And, you know, that was just, you know, they became our world. Those Famous Five, Secret Seven, Mallory Towers. We would just be those characters, you know, the way you would. You know, and your bed would become your circus or your train or your boat.
Awesome. And so, like, Enid Blyton, was that, so you were reading yourself at that stage? You were reading Enid Blyton books yourself at that stage? You weren't being read to?
I do remember my dad reading us, like, bedtime stories. I remember Noddy being one of the bedtime stories that my dad read to us. So we obviously did have picture books. I don't have a very clear memory of any other ones apart from that one. And then, yeah, so my mom would bring home the books, or we'd get them in the library, and myself and my sister would swap them with each other. And then we would gather all our teddies around and become the Famous Five. My sister was always Anne, I was always George. And then my old teddy bear was Timmy the dog. I don't remember who the boys were. We probably just picked a few dolls for the other characters.
Brilliant.
They weren't that important.
Oh, so, like, the library has been in your blood, in your DNA, nearly just from the very, very start. Like,
yeah, I mean, obviously I had no idea I was going to end up working in the libraries, but yeah, then we moved to Raheny just before my 8th birthday, and there was a beautiful library in Raheny, like a proper big library, about maybe 7 or 8 minutes walk from the house. Now, I'm sure my mom or dad would have brought me down initially to enroll me there to get my card, but my overriding memories are just going on my own to that library and feeling like it was a place where you're given autonomy. You could just go in, choose whatever book you wanted to. You were trusted to bring back the books that you had borrowed, you know, in good condition. You know, you kept your side of the bargain. You brought back the books, and then you could choose the books yourself. And nobody was, you know, telling you what you had to read. So it was it was great freedom in that. So I just worked my way through Raheny Library, through the fiction section, really. Don't remember choosing much nonfiction, unless it was for a school project. But for pleasure, it was definitely all fiction.
It's true, that kind of trust and autonomy, isn't it? And you have that kind of, you probably can read way outside of maybe what might have been prescribed for you at that age. You know, you have that, and you're right, there's no judgment. You choose what you want, bring it home. It is it's kind of amazing, really, when you think about it, what libraries can offer a child.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And I see it now from working in the library. I mean, the library can be a real safe place for some kids, you know, where they can just be themselves. No expectations on you when you come into a library. You can sit in the corner and read whatever you want, and nobody's going to bother you.
But so some of these series, I'm laughing because I read some of them too, they probably could be nothing further from our kind of like Irish experience, you know, like Sweet Valley High. I loved Sweet Valley High. It was just, I mean, could you get anything further away?
It was hilarious. I was thinking about it last night. So we read Sweet Valley High in primary school in sixth class.
Yeah.
So, you know, you would have spent most of your school lunchtime running around, playing chasing, playing hide and seek. But then when we got to sixth class, we were like 11, 12. And I don't know who discovered the Sweet Valley High books, but somebody did. And then they just became this hot property.
The
way my son used to swap Match Attack cards, for us, it was Sweet Valley High books. There was loads of books in the series. I can't remember how many numbers it went up to. So have you got number 21? Have you got number 17? And we sat on the gravel, like in a dark, you know, a grey Dublin of 1980s, pale-faced, you know, freckled kids, so far removed from these beautiful twins, Jessica and Elizabeth, I think their names were. Yeah. And they were blonde, they were from California, they were tanned, they had boyfriends.
Oh, boyfriends with names boyfriends, like Todd.
And we just galloped up these stories. Yeah. We, you know, as you say, just so different from what we were living, but maybe that was the thing. It was the fantasy, wasn't it? It was just losing yourself in a different world. And maybe we thought when we went to secondary school, this was going to be this is going to be our world too.
It was like the illusions of, you know, English boarding school in Mallory Towers as well. You know, it was kind of like, it couldn't have been. Yeah, it's, there's another book here that in the same kind of vein, you know, things that maybe you shouldn't be reading at the age you were reading. Somebody else mentioned this before, and we did all read it, didn't we? The Flowers in the Attic.
Yes. Oh my God, what is, like, the creepiest story ever. And now, it was definitely older. It was secondary school. I can't remember what age, maybe around 15, 16. Yeah. But that was, like the Sweet Valley High, this was the book everybody was reading. I looked it up last night. I think it was published in the 70s, but we would have been reading it around late 80s, I think.
Late 80s, uh-huh.
Yeah. Late 80s. And it's just like gothic story of these kids. Like,
it's horrific.
That's more or less up in the attic. And there's all sorts of stuff going on.
I think that was part of it as well. That was kind of passed around as kind of, you know, get to page 69
Black market,
or whatever
it was. Wasn't
it really? Was there... I was trying to think with this, and I didn't look it up because I wanted to ask you. Was there a sequel to it, or was there another?
There was a whole series of Seconds in the Wind.
Seconds in the Wind, yes.
I think there was five or six. I don't know whether we read them all, but we definitely read a few to see what happened. I won't give any spoilers if people haven't read them, but yeah, I mean, definitely not suitable.
No.
Reading material, which just makes it all the more exciting, doesn't it?
Yeah. So this is you as a teenager, and Jackie, where were you at this point? Like, what school were you in, and what kind
of... Yeah, so living in Raheny, went to Manor House School, very academic school. I was lucky that it was academic, so it suited me. I was getting into music around the 15, 16. I got really big into music and was very lucky to have gathered a tribe of music-loving people around me, and we just went to gigs all the time. So we would go to, like, the Hot House Flares were my band from the time I was 14 to 17. I was obsessed. So lots of music, lots of going to gigs. I would have been in a class with very engaged people, with engaged teachers discussing lots of different things. So I was reading books like Against the Tide by Noel Brown. A book that was a big influence, I remember, was Is That It by Bob Geldof. So the Boomtown Rats were the era before me. So I didn't grow up with the Boomtown Rats music, but would have been aware of it from listening to Dave Fanning, I guess. I mean, I was a massive Dave Fanning fan. Like, that was on every night in the house all through the whole way through secondary school, I guess. You know, even through doing exams, I would have been just listening to it. I would never turned it off. So I would have known the music, would have seen Bob Geldof on The Late Late Show, would have known who he was. And then just fascinated by this autobiography, like reading his story and the music and how, you know, he was kind of frustrated really because he wanted the band to do better than they did. And then he became known, of course, for Live Aid and Band Aid. So yeah, I remember reading that book and being really influenced by that. And then just reading, I guess, what was on the curriculum and then what we passed around between us. And what else was I reading around that time? I remember there was a book called Go Ask Alice. I think I might have mentioned that one in my notes. And I was really shocked. I looked it up and I thought, so it was about a girl who became a drug addict, a 15-year-old girl. It was published, I think, maybe in the 70s, but it became one of those books that we were passing around in secondary school. And a really dark, grim story. And I found my diary from the year when I was 16. I was reading it recently and I mentioned this book in the diary, and I mentioned it a few times, you know, as I'm reading it, I'm saying, oh my gosh, this book is, you know, it's so powerful and it's really disturbing. And then when I get to the end, I'm like, oh God, I can't believe it. You know, I think I had grown up on a reading books where even if something awful happened, there was some kind of redemption at the end. And this book didn't have that. There was a really sad ending. When I looked it up a few weeks ago, I was horrified to find out that it's fiction. There's some woman in her 30s had written it, and had written several books in that style of diary, and I was convinced it was true. Convinced.
Oh my goodness. That's quite It's quite modern in a way, actually. That kind of fictional memoir. That's interesting. I'd never heard of it before. So this is published in 1971. And she's a series of them.
Yeah, which I didn't know about. And now I'm thinking it was probably written as this kind of moral tale for teenagers, don't touch drugs.
Oh, it could be, actually, yeah.
But it worked. It's not many, anyway. No, I didn't really. I was really terrified by this book.
So is your... I know you maybe we're going to talk about this later on, but your diary then, so you mentioned books throughout your diary, like what you're listening to and what you're reading, is that included a lot or just now and again?
Not that many. That one in particular, because obviously it had a huge impact on me. I think I was mentioning books that maybe that we were reading in school as well. Mostly the diary from that year anyway, from when I was 16, was music.
Yeah.
And actually what really fascinated me, nothing to do with books, but religion. I'm really, like, I would have said, you know, that I would have stopped, you know, going to mass when I was 14 or 15, but no, when I read that diary, reread it, was going to Mass right through until I reached my 17th birthday. That's when the diary stopped. And I was kind of fascinated by that, that it was such a big thing. I mean, it was 1991, and I did go to a Catholic school, but I was kind of surprised by that, that how strong religion was still in my life at that stage, even though, you know, I would have been very aware of politics and current affairs. And yeah, kind of, but I suppose that was the Catholic upbringing I had.
But also, I wonder why you stopped writing your diary then too, around that age.
Oh, I didn't actually, I mean, that was a daily diary. So that was like squashed into this tiny little book, a couple of, you know, maybe 6 or 7 lines for each day. I did keep up a diary, but not in the same sort of daily.
Okay, so more of a kind of a contemplative kind of.
Yeah, if something happened. So I did have one for 92, but it wouldn't have been every single day. But that was kind of fascinating to me because every day was covered. So I was getting the minutiae of,
and that's, know, like, yeah, life. That's almost more telling as well, what you chose in those few words to kind of note about your day, your experience, to get a better glimpse into maybe just who you were or what you were doing.
Yeah, and I remember when my dad died, going back to some of my diaries and being really surprised how little he was mentioned in them, and not in a bad way. I think it was actually, in a way, it was a good thing, because I had such a lovely relationship with my parents that there was no drama. So at one point I mentioned, it might have been in that one actually, the 1991 one, that he'd gone over to London to run the marathon. So, you know, there's pages and pages of me talking about going into town, meeting so-and-so outside HMB, you know, ringing somebody, calling into somebody, going to work. And then my dad gets this like one line mentioned to say he'd ran the London Marathon in such time. This massive thing that he'd been training for months and months. And, you know, he gets one line. So I was kind of sad that there wasn't more about him, but actually I think, you know, on reflection, I think it's a good thing because, as I said, they were there in the background loving me and supporting me, and I wasn't giving them really any hassle. So there was no big drama or fights or anything like that.
Yeah, the kind of mission is just a mission of happiness, basically, or of peacefulness or contentment that you didn't need to. Yeah. When you say you were going to Mass and you were going to church, and you use the word like religion there, Jackie, but did you have a spiritual life when you were younger, or did you have a, like, would you use that word, or would you use the word faith, or like, are you talking about,
I don't think I
use
spiritual, but definitely faith. And I would have definitely, I mean, we grew up in a very, I suppose it was just most people I knew were Catholic, and we went to Mass, and my parents would have gone to Mass every week, and I definitely believed very strongly in God. And I would have been praying to God. If I was worried about something, I would pray about it. And then, yeah, I guess that continued probably just maybe till around 17. And then I suppose all the scandals in the church made me think differently. And now I don't have any faith at all. But I suppose it did surprise me how strong it was still up until that point in my life, because I would have, if you had asked me and I hadn't read the diaries, I would have said, oh no, you know, probably 15 or so, I probably stopped
earlier
to Mass. But I was going to Mass every day during Lent. And yeah, it was part of the culture, I think, as well at the time.
Sure, of course.
In the school, and I didn't question it a huge amount, I think.
So I wonder, did music kind of come in to fill that space? It feels like
it,
from reading.
Yeah, I think so. I think music definitely did. But actually, it's funny because when I was reading the diary, I had my 50th there a few weeks ago, and a couple of my really close friends came over, and I was reading at the diary. We were just roaring laughing at some of the stuff. But I'd say something like, oh, we're going to see something happens in the SFX. But before that, I'd be like, so I got 6:30 Mass, and then we got the bus into town. Like, a bit, you know, there was no missing Mass to go to. That definitely changed. I think by the following year, nothing would have stopped me going to a gig. Gigs were definitely the forefront. But for that year, yeah, the two of them sort of mixed together, and then music took over. It is not, yeah.
Wow. Do you remember your first gig?
My first gig, yeah, it was the Thompson Twins in the National Stadium. My sister won tickets on Radio 2, and she was, I think, 12, so I was about 9 or 10, maybe I was 10 and she was almost 13, we were young. And my dad, like, now we laugh about it, how will we let go to this concert? But my dad used to box, so he was familiar with the National Stadium. So he dropped us off, we went in, we were so clueless, so we just walked up to the front row and stood at this barrier, which I was tiny. It was absolutely tiny. And of course, I fainted and had to be carried over the barrier by John of God ambulance and brought to the back. And then just had to sit out the rest of the concert. My poor dad, when he went to collect us, I was like, oh my gosh, you know. And I didn't go to another concert again then until I was 14. And we went to see the Hot House Flowers in the RDS, that brilliant outdoor concert where they played with Deacon Blue and Tracy Chapman, who of course is
again.
And that was just incredible. I went with my sister and her friend, and we were up in, now we were well away from the grounds, we were up in the seated area, but I was just blown away. And that just started my love affair really with the Hot House Flowers. That continued on until I was probably in my late teens, and they were a huge part of my teenage years.
That's such a great story. Your poor dad. I'm just thinking of you, thinking of your first like gig, and he's like, okay, no, I'm going to let it go. And then,
I wonder, they might have thought it was seated. They probably didn't really, they probably just thought it was a seated concert that we were sitting at, didn't really think about it. And of course, we didn't have a clue. So just, oh, there's the stage, let's go up.
Brilliant.
Hanging little tops.
Well, you were talking about love affair there with music, but something I loved in Traces it's a poem, but it tells a story of how you met your husband, which is just, there's a few things, you talk about a lot in Traces, and there's a lovely one about the dress that you wore in, where was it? Were you in Greece? That's just so beautiful. But I wanted to ask you about this first encounter with your husband, because it was a book that's just so perfect. How can you have such a fitting, meet cute? I don't know. It's just like, honestly, if you could have like written this for yourself, it's so lovely. So if you tell us what the book was that brought you together.
Okay, the book is called A Simple Plan by Scott Smith. So I went down to Kilkenny in March 1995. My friend Gillian invited me down for the weekend. There was some story about a boy that had stopped ringing me or something, so she was feeling sorry for me. Come on down to Kilkenny. So she was going out with her boyfriend, and I met Brian that night because he was Gillian's boyfriend's cousin, and they were really good friends. And we met in a pub where all great Irish romances begin. And we just got chatting, and I just started working in the library. So I was only about 2 months into my career. I didn't know it was going to be a career. I told my parents I was taking the job for a couple of months until I got the job I wanted. Famous last words from everybody in public service. We got chatting, and he asked me where I was working. So I said I worked in a library, and then we got talking about what you're reading, and he was telling me about this book called A Simple Plan. I hadn't read it, but I could visualize it because I had seen it on the shelf in Downmead Library. I could still picture where it was. It was to the right of the door where we went into the canteen for a break, where the S's were all, alphabetically catalogued or shelved. And we just got chatting about that book. And I think it was just having something to talk about. You know, the way sometimes, those initial conversations, and they could run dry very quickly.
Yeah.
But Brian was a great reader, is a huge reader. And we just got chatting. And then we ended up just chatting for hours and hours. Like, we're there, just the two of us sitting on the steps in the Pump House pub. And then we didn't get together for it was a couple of months later before our romance started, but that was definitely, I didn't think I'd ever see him again. I went back to Dublin and I was telling my friends, I met this gorgeous fellow. And I go, oh my God, did you kiss? I was like, no, we parted ways. I'll never see him again. And there's a longer story how we ended up together, but you probably don't know.
I wouldn't mind hearing that, actually.
Well, what happened was then, so I didn't think I'd ever see him again. And then about 6 weeks later, I was in Bussaras waiting to get a bus to Drogheda to Gillian's 21st party. And I was meeting her boyfriend there because we were going to get the bus up together. And lo and behold, there's Brian standing beside Adrian. And I just was like, oh my God.
Completely coincidentally.
He'd found out that I was going to the party and invited himself along. Which is not like him. He's really, he was really shy. But so then, of course, we ended up chatting all night again. And then there was another story. We didn't get together that night. But on the next day, he paced up and down his house in Kilkenny and eventually plucked up the courage and rang Dublin City Libraries to speak to me. They put him through to Downmead Library. I got this call, went into the office, couldn't believe it. And he asked me, would I come down to Kilkenny for the comedy festival? It was the very first year of the Cat Laughs. And we'd been talking about that at the party. And he said, will you come down? And I said, yes. And that was it. We started going out that was the 3rd of June. It was the bank holiday weekend. And yeah, we're together ever since.
That's just, and you're right about the timing of this and how, you know, maybe it was too soon or you felt, but it wasn't. It was perfect timing. And I just, this book, I mean, just even the questions I'm asking and I'm thinking, going back to Traces and thinking about that, there's so much like there's the romance in it and the love in it and the warmth and the kind of all of that. And then there's also, I think there's so much that's relatable, particularly for women. Anyway, that's what I thought, particularly about, you know, living with pain, with body image. You know, you talk about endometriosis, you talk about IBS. But it's also, for me, I thought it was really very, very encouraging in a lot of ways, like very, maybe encouraging is not the right word, or uplifting is not the right word, but I found a lot in it for me, you know. And I wanted to ask you if there have been, well, I know that there have been books like this in your life, and I'm kind of interested. There are two ones I want to ask you about. First one is a book that your mother gave you in your 20s, and you say that this was a book that, like, helped you in some way or taught you something, or tell us about
yeah,
that book.
So I think I was probably only about 19 or 20 when she gave it to me, or definitely early 20s. There's a book called Awareness by Anthony DeMello. And my mom had got quite interested in those kind of books. I suppose self-help books were kind of called, you know, but this book sort of blew my mind because I think he's a Buddhist. I had a copy and I was reading it and I can't find it this morning to show you. I don't know where I put it. It's in the house somewhere. Yeah, it was like just kind of opened my eyes to different ways. I suppose at that stage in my life, you know, I was very insecure. And I guess, you know, all you want is to have a boyfriend, to be popular, you know, at that age when you just want to fit in and, you know, you want what everybody else has. And this book was about finding your own way, I guess. And, you know, there was a lovely piece in it about, they were like little, almost like little parables, little stories. That's what the book is. And this idea of, you know, when you're dancing with somebody, enjoy the dance, but when the dance is finished, it doesn't mean you have to be sad. You know, this kind of idea of, you create your own happiness, really, that you shouldn't be looking for somebody else to validate you, which was probably what I was hoping for. I was hoping for a romance. I was hoping, you know, for somebody to tell me I was attractive and worthy and all that. And this book was about, I suppose, finding it within. Now, I don't think I found it within that quickly. I mean, I think that's like a lifelong journey, isn't it? To be happy with yourself. But definitely made me think in a different way about life. And my mom found it hugely helpful and said to me, I think you should read this. And then there was a really lovely girl in my class in college called Aoife who was quite interested in that kind of books as well. And she gave me a copy of You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. And yeah, so I guess I was reading stuff like that to try and make sense of who I was and why maybe that I wasn't confident and wasn't happy with how I looked or how I was in the world. So those kind of books became quite important. And I guess they probably still are in some ways. I'm always reading to try and figure myself out, you know, figure out who I am. And it's
would you say that began then in your 20s, Jackie? Because I know from reading some of the essays and Traces and, you know, there's been various points in your life where, not that there's been an epiphany particularly, but like you've started down a path saying, okay, I want to change how I feel about this or about that. Did that begin then with around that time when you're reading those kind of books that you were at least beginning to question how you saw yourself, you know, or your physical self?
I think it was about questioning how I felt about myself. Not so much. I think the essay I wrote about body image, I mean, it took me a long, long time to figure that out, like way too long. So that's only really in my 40s.
Yeah.
And shockingly long time for somebody who's well-read and educated, but...
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of us don't get there at all. I was very impressed with that. And I think a lot of people will find that really like pivotal for them, whatever age. But I don't think, I mean, I think growing up in the culture that, you know, we grew up in, I mean, it's unsurprising that it takes this long.
Yeah, you know? I guess so. But I suppose maybe I was being a bit hard on myself. Yeah, but I just sort of think, gosh, I can't believe I'm in my early 40s and I'm still worrying about this shit.
Yeah.
Seriously, cop on, you know, get a grip on yourself. But look, thankfully, I that's the one thing, I guess, with the stuff that I've written about IBS, I think that's always going to be something that I'm still trying to figure out how to deal with an illness. But definitely with the body image stuff, I really feel like, yeah, I've reached the stage where it doesn't concern me at all. And that's a really freeing feeling. And I'm delighted that I got there, you know. But yeah, I suppose I would have started that journey in my 20s and maybe got lost along the way.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's another great book that I don't know whether I mentioned it, Help Me by Marianne Parr, which yes. I love as well.
Oh, yes, I wanted to ask you about this. But I was laughing actually when I read about this because I had a friend who had a year of saying yes to everything, and then I had a friend who had a year of saying no to everything. And I was like, both of them seemed like really appealing to me in different ways. I was like, I don't know which one. So yeah, tell me what was this? What was this
book,
about?
I got this book from my friend Cormac Kinsley, sent me a copy. I think it was just before it was due to be published, and I read it in the weekend, and I remember texting him saying, is this actually true? Did she do all this stuff? It's incredible. So the idea behind it was, Marianne is from England, but she has a, you know, very strong Irish connections. She would have grown up, her family are Irish, and she would have spent a lot of time in Kerry as a child. And she was saying she was always reading these self-help books, and there was loads of them under her, you know, under her bed. So she'd buy them and she'd read a couple of chapters, but never implemented any of the recommendations. So, you know, she wasn't really getting anything out of them because she wasn't putting in the work. So she decided, I can't remember what year it was, but she was going to follow the instructions in the book, pick a different book every month and actually follow what they say. So this book is her exploration of that year. And it's very funny and it's very entertaining, but it's quite moving in parts because at a certain point during the year, she realizes that it's all become a bit too much, and she hits quite a low point, and her friends need to intervene. So it's definitely not all light. But I found it just really inspiring, actually, in a lot of ways. I mean, can't remember all the books that she did, but there was, you know, the power of saying, oh, what is it called? About saying yes to things.
Yes.
I can't remember that book. Oh, I'll have to look it up later. I'll send you the titles. And just going off and doing things like being a model, you know, for art classes, you know, the nude model.
Oh, right,
art class. Doing stand-up comedy, you know, things like
that. Oh, my God,
terrifying.
That's terrifying. Yeah.
Oh. Absolutely terrifying. jumping into a lake and swimming on New Year's Day in the cold, asking somebody out on a date.
Oh gosh, I thought it was actually going to be something less kind of, I thought it was more kind of on a more of a micro level, you know, if someone says, would you like to go for a coffee? I was like, that's the level I was thinking of. And
it's really putting yourself out of your comfort zone, because the idea behind it is, what is the worst thing that can happen? So what's the worst thing? Yeah, so it was about basically not being afraid, because that's what stops most of us doing things, isn't it? It's the fear of failure. It's the fear of humiliation. So the worst thing that can possibly happen, if you ask somebody out on a date, is they say no. That's all. You're not going to die. But you kind of build yourself up. So I just found it really inspiring, and it kind of made me say yes to a lot of stuff. But it's interesting what you're saying about saying no, because actually this year my plan is to say no to a lot of things.
Which can be equally liberating, can't it? You kind of go, I'm not missing out, I don't want to do it. Or I've learned to say, someone said to me, the advice I got, you know, you know, sometimes you have to come up, or you think you need to come up with an excuse, I can't do this, and then you go into the whole reasoning why, and you can just say, because I don't want to.
Yeah, which is very difficult for us to do. And if you're a people pleaser like me, it's almost impossible to do something like that. But I've found great inspiration. I don't know whether you ever listened to Elizabeth Day's podcast, her How to Fail. Have you ever listened to that?
I've heard of her, but I haven't listened to the podcast, no.
Yeah, she's great. So she's an English writer and journalist, and her podcasts are about interviewing people about things in their lives that they considered failures, but what they learned from them. But she also talks a lot about, got a book out called Friendaholic, and it's a lot about just, you know, finding your boundaries, setting boundaries, and not going along with stuff because we feel we have to. That, and like you say, you can say no to things. You can, if somebody asks you, you don't have to go into a big explanation. You can just say, thank you so much for asking me. I'm not available. That's it. You don't have to feel, and then, you know, this guilt that we load onto ourselves. And then what happens is you end up feeling wrecked all the time because you say yes to things that you don't have the energy for. And for me, especially with the IBS, like my energy levels are really low. And so I'm going to be taking some time off work for a few months, and I definitely feel this is the year where I have to say yes to things that suit me and make me feel well, and no to things that are going to, you know, take any energy away that I don't have.
Because you have to be careful where you put that energy and what you're channeling it into. You really do. No, I completely know where you're coming from with that. And it's, you spread yourself too thin, especially if you are caring or if you're looking after elderly parents or children and working or all of it. You have to, you can't say yes to everything or you'll just implode.
You just burn out, don't you? And I think what we find it hard, I definitely have this issue with productivity, the feeling that I have to use my time productively all the time. I mean, there's a great piece in Sarah Baum's Handiwork. I don't know whether you've read that book about what should I be doing? Should I be reading this book or watching this film or creating this thing? You know, we're bombarded with choices, and it can feel like if you have a day off that I should be doing something productive.
Yeah, that word use your day off. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. That those two verbs, use and be. And sometimes, like, I know you've had this as well with your phone. I've been trying to kind of get rid of the compulsion, you know, where you have almost this invisible hand that you lift up. I'm trying to very hard to kind of break up with it. And that sense of being really expands when it's gone and you're just like on the beach, or even just standing in the garden, just standing in the garden, not taking a picture or all of those things. And so I could see some of that in Traces as well, that sense of just breathing and existing is fine. You know, you don't have to be, you know, writing the next chapter of your book, or, you know, cleaning out the cupboard or fixing the hinge or doing all the 500,000 things you have lined up to do. It's hard, though. It's hard to kind of,
I think it's the most difficult thing in at the moment for me is, the phone is just such a nuisance. And I mean, there's nothing more freeing than going out somewhere and realizing you've left your phone behind.
Exactly.
And that you don't have it. Because the initial panic of how will somebody contact me? And then there's just this huge weight off your shoulders that I'm just being today. Yeah. I'm not going to take a photo of anything. Yeah. I'm not going to scroll through Twitter while I'm in the car. I'm just going to talk to the person with me, or listen to the music, or, you know, look at the landscape, whatever it is. And we've lost that. Like, it's kind of crazy how much we've lost that, you know, we just sit on the bus and daydream.
Yeah, we've definitely lost that daydreaming. I mean, talking to my daughter about it, and there just isn't a period of time that isn't filled with, you know, with I don't know, I suppose consuming images or consuming information into your brain. And I think it's not healthy, I don't think.
No, it's really unhealthy, actually. I think most of us kind of know it's unhealthy now, but it's very difficult to stop it. It's really difficult.
No, and then we call it,
I talk about it because you think, I should be able to do this. But actually, I mean, it's not our fault, really, because, I mean, those apps are made to make you get the dopamine hit, and you go back for more, and it's all carefully created that way to make us keep going back to the phones.
Do you find yourself, I find myself, if I'm reading, I have to put the phone somewhere else in the house, and not because I'm distracted. I'll be reading the book, but I'll find myself, even without realizing that I'm doing it, I'll be reading a book. Before I know it, the book will be down beside me and my phone will be in my face. And I don't even remember putting the book down or lifting the phone up, but it happens, and it happens all the time. It's a reflex.
It's shocking, actually, how bad my attention levels have gone. Like, I'm very easily distracted by my phone. Yeah. So much so, I might only read a few pages of a book and then I reach for my phone.
Yeah, I would be the same.
It's shocking, and it drives me crazy. It really saddens me, actually, how much the phone has taken control. Or, you know, I'm not in control of the phone. The phone is in control of me, and I'm really trying. And that's an ongoing battle that's been going on for years with my phone.
I think even recognizing it is a good step anyway. I think it's a lot, you know, we've recognized it, we're trying to put it away. But yeah, it's, I think with reading and with films, I find that that's where I really need to just put the phone somewhere else. Because watching a film, you know, you're almost like you've got two screens going on sometimes. And it's just, I think we all know it. I think we all know it. But there is just nothing nicer than getting into bed, phone is somewhere else. You have your book, and that's that's what's in your hand. Do you know what I mean?
Getting lost in the story. And well, actually, I've started going to films this year, which is great, because when you're in the cinema, you can't look at your phone.
Yes.
You get completely lost in the film. And I'm really enjoying that. It's actually, yeah, it's something that I'm going to keep up for the year, is going to films regularly.
I think we need to get back to our Generation X childhood and just get back to where it was before we... And I do think it maybe is a generational thing as well, you know, because we grew up without it, then we're exposed to it. We're experiencing it differently in some sense. I'm sure there will be loads of research about this in about 20 years' time, and we'll go, ha-ha!
Yeah, I guess we know what we're missing. Maybe our children don't know what we're missing because they didn't have that, whereas we can remember back to when we were lost in a book where we sat on... you know, on a bus and we had that, we were lucky to have it, but now we miss it because, you know, we're back for it. So we kind of have that to measure up against. We know
that's probably true. And you were talking about the library at the beginning, and I remember those kind of chunky, it's probably different. I grew up in the north, so I remember these kind of cardboard, like brown library little pocket things and the tickets and, you know, going running down to the library. I can't imagine that there'd be the same thing now. Similar maybe, but not the same, not with everything that's competing for that was it, you know, that was the media.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now we sound like when I was young. I want to bring you back a wee bit to I know we touched on this earlier on. We were talking about pain, and I know you don't mind talking about this, Jack. I know you've spoken about this fairly openly before, but you do talk about like pain throughout your life, and as a young woman, like the heavy periods and later on finding out about endometriosis, but the shame that goes with that, and then later on the IBS, and just how kind of, you know, all consuming that is in your life. And I know that, well, you've mentioned that a book by Sinead Gleeson that was important to you, and was it important to you in beginning to write about all of this? Was that kind of, was she a writer that kind of inspired you, or was this about a particular poem
Sinead's writing definitely inspired me. Constellations is one of my favorite books of all time. It's just stunning. Like, her writing is just exquisite. Like, every sentence is beautifully crafted, but she writes about topics that really interest me. You know, she's writing about music, she's writing about family. She does a beautiful essay about her auntie who had Alzheimer's disease, stuff that I could really relate to. But her essays on illness just really spoke to me. You know, that sense of when Sinead had much more serious illnesses than me. She had leukemia, and so I'm lucky that I didn't have that level of illness, but I have been in hospital for operations. And there is that sense when you go in the door, you're so vulnerable. You really don't have any autonomy. You're completely giving yourself over to the medical staff and their decisions. And she just describes that so well. And one of the essays, she's talking about Jo Spence, actually, who photographed herself when she had breast cancer. But she's talking about this idea of all these doctors crowding around the hospital bed. And that, when I read that, it just sparked this memory in me of when I was giving birth to my first son, Liam. And, you know, you're so naive when you're pregnant for the first time. I remember reading all the books and they were talking about birth plans, and you know, write out your birth plan. And so in my, you know, innocence, writing out this birth plan and handing it over to the midwife and thinking this was how it was all going to pan out, the irony of it all. Mm. And, you know, 30 hours later, you know, you're still trying to deliver this baby. But I remember it was 30 hours into the labor and I couldn't even speak. I was so exhausted. And like, any sense of being in control completely gone. You know, I was not in control of anything. And a consultant swept into the room because, you know, they were worried, you know, the baby wasn't coming. And all these junior doctors, you know, or student doctors with them. And is it okay if these, you know, student doctors look in? Like, I could barely say my name at that point. I wasn't even going to argue with that. You know, I think I obviously muttered yes to them. But it was just that sense of, you know, nothing was, you know, they were in control of everything. And it didn't matter what I was, you know, I had to just hand over to them. And look, my baby was delivered safely and he was well. And but I did find it a very bruising experience, to be honest. And even when the anaesthetist came in to give me the epidural, like, it didn't work. I remember it didn't work. And hours later, I was saying to them, well, my back is killing me. And they were like, oh, no, you shouldn't feel any pain. And just not having the confidence to have said that hours earlier, and thinking because this male doctor has come in with full of confidence and assurance, so of course he knows what he's doing, and not having, you know, not being able to speak up for myself. And I think a lot of people find themselves in that position in a medical situation, that it's very hard to advocate for yourself. And Sinead just describes that so brilliantly in Constellations, you know, having to fight for yourself. And it's not easy to do that when you're ill, because you're so vulnerable. You don't have the strength to articulate what your needs are, because often you don't even know what your needs are. So you really are placing all your trust in the medical profession. And sometimes, you know, they're wonderful. I've had brilliant doctors, and Sinead says that herself, that she's had some brilliant doctors, but they're not all great. And they're not always great at telling you what's going on or explaining things to you. And because I've been within the medical system since I was a teenager, and will be in it probably till I die, I've had lots of different experiences of good and bad doctors, and feeling like I was heard and feeling like I wasn't heard. And I find the most frustrating thing, I think, about the whole thing about the IBS, I've had it since I was 19, so this is going on 30 years, is that there's no joint up thinking about it. It's all very medicalized. It's like, try this, try that. But it's no sense of, how are you doing holistic person? And I remember a friend of mine saying to me a few years ago, have you ever had counselling for it? And I said, no. And she said, has anybody ever suggested that to you? I said, no. Like, it just wouldn't occur to you. And the last time I was in with the consultant was in August. And like, she more or less said, you know, they can't find a physical reason for the IBS after doing all the tests, more and more tests. I was just so upset that, you know, I thought, right, this is it. I'm going to have this till I die. And I remember, you know, trying to talk to her about that. She didn't want to know, really. You know, they don't want to know about your emotional well-being, because, you know, they don't have the time for it, maybe. But I didn't feel like there was a lot of empathy for me and what I was struggling with emotionally with getting this, you know, these results that actually, no, we can't figure this out. You're kind of left on your own, really. And I find it kind of shocking, really, but not shocking, but not really shocking, you know, after all the years. And yeah, so Constellations is the book that I think just captures it so brilliantly in Sinead's beautiful writing. And it's not all just about health, there's loads of other essays in it as well, but I'd highly recommend Constellations to anybody who hasn't read it.
And well, I would highly recommend Traces, having read it, to people listening. It's a book of poems and essays. I was saying to you, Jackie, before we started that it's been a long time since I've read a poetry collection that makes me, it's Moorish. I'm just saying it's Moorish, that I read one poem, I want to go straight on to the next poem. I find myself like nodding a lot throughout it, and kind of, and I've underlined just a few, just, I don't know, there were just a few things, even like sprinkled generously with guilt and beat to a pulp. I just, you know, there were just some things that really, immersed in the swell of a past season when I was known by my first name, a little bit like what we were just talking there about the kind of abandonment and surrender of birth, when you're just kind of, people talk to you like they just call you mom in the middle of all your pain, and you're like, you know, what, where did my name go in this, and your autonomy and everything. But it's just, it's as well, it's just full of such, like, such life and enthusiasm, and it's so moving. I'm going to move myself to tears now. Aww, so but it's good. I would totally, I just recommend this to everybody. I'm going to give this to a friend the next time I see her. And I'm really curious to know what you're going to read for us to finish, because you wouldn't tell me at the start because you're going to see.
Well, I wasn't sure, because I said I wouldn't see how the conversation went. So now actually I'm going to change my mind, and I'm not going to read what I was going to read. I think because we're having that conversation about childbirth, I'm going to read the poem that was initially inspired by Sinead Gleason's writing. So this is called Silenced, and it was originally published in Washing Windows Anthology, which is published by Arlen House. So I was really pleased that it was published there, and it's included in Traces. Silenced. I'm naked from the waist down when they arrive. Cavalry of white coats, baby-faced, blank stares, incapable of summoning words, my tongue ripped out by medical artillery. It's been 30 hours since my waters broke. The birth plans flung to the ether, a no man's land of paper wishes, compiled by anxious women in the dead of the night when heartburn's scraping sleep from bones. The midwife shoves a gloved finger deep inside me, 1 to 2 centimetres dilated. Stoic and silent until midday, when water and bile are violently expelled and any pretense of being in control evaporates. A week later, the bill for the failed anaesthetic arrives. Put up, shut up, pay up. No plans conceived for second and third labours. I'm not the captain of this army.
You've been listening to the fabulous Jackie Lynham reading from her debut collection, Traces, which is out now. See you all next time.